echoing sensors. Nothing in their escort's power usage or weapons systems that indicated attack preparation, and the X-Wing's own systems were reading fully operative. "How far to the fortress Mara found?" he asked. R2 beeped. "Less than 15 minutes at their current speed." "Sometime in the next 10 minutes, I guess," Luke told him. "Be ready." Taking a deep breath, settling his hands on the controls, he consciously relaxed his muscles and immersed himself in the Force. They were registering 6 minutes to the fortress, and the canyon Mara had flown down had just appeared paralleling them on the distant horizon when it finally happened. In perfect unison, the two escort ships threw a quick spurt of power to their forward thrusters, dropping from flanking into following positions behind the X-Wing as their velocities blipped down. And from nozzles nestled half-hidden beneath their cockpits, spat a deadly salvo of blue fire. But their target was no longer there. An instant before the aliens' thrusters had fired, Luke had caught the subtle disturbance in the Force. And by the time their weapons flashed, he had thrown the X-Wing into a sharp climb, curving up and around in a tight loop that would take him back around into attack position behind his attackers. Or at least that was the normal endpoint of the maneuver. This time, though, Luke had other plans. Instead of pulling out of his loop behind the aliens, he held the X-Wing's nose pointed toward the ground for an extra pair of heartbeats. Then, at what seemed like the last second, he twisted the starfighter into a stomach-wrenching twin rotational turn. An instant later, they were running bare meters above the ground on a vector perpendicular to their original course. "What are they doing?" Luke called, not daring to take his eyes away from the landscape long enough to look for himself. The droid's warning screech and a sudden tingling in the Force were his answer. From behind came another volley of blue fire, most of it going wide, but a few shots splattering off his rear deflector shield. "Any new friends join them?" he called. R2 warbled a negative. That was something, anyway. Still, those ships were good, and the crews clearly knew what they were doing. At 2-1 odds, Luke was going to have his hands full. Especially since... R2 twittered an urgent question. "No, leave the S-foils as they are," Luke told him. "We're not going to shoot back." The droid's question was a disbelieving whistle. "Because we don't know who they are or why they're here," Luke told him, eyes measuring the ground ahead. Just beyond Mara's canyon, the terrain abruptly became something shattered-looking, broken into granite-walled cliffs and deep, sharp-edged crevices. "I don't want to kill any of them until I know who and what they are." R2's rejoinder became another screech as the latest enemy salvo blew a thin layer of metal from the top of the starboard S-foil. "Don't worry, we're almost there," Luke soothed him, risking a quick glance at his status displays. No serious damage yet, but that wouldn't last long once the attackers got a little closer. Which meant that his best hope was to keep that from happening. Behind him, R2 whistled suspiciously. "That's exactly where we're going," Luke confirmed. They were nearly to the shattered landscape now, and off to port side, he spotted a likely-looking gorge. "Oh, relax. It's no worse than some of the other things we've pulled off," he added, twisting the X-Wing's nose toward the gorge. "Anyway, we haven't got a choice. Hang on. Here we go." Beggar's Canyon on Tatooine had been a tricky but familiar obstacle run of twists and corners and switchbacks. The Death Star Trench had been far straighter, but with the addition of turbo laser fire and attacking TIE fighters to keep it interesting. Now, the Nerowan cliffs took the challenge a step farther by adding unpredictable curves and breakpoints with varying widths and depths, jutting rocks, and clinging tree vines. The newly signed rebel recruit at Yavin would have recognized the risks involved. Even the cocky adolescent on Tatooine would have hesitated at the stupidity of tackling such an unknown labyrinth at such high speeds. The seasoned Jedi Luke had become, though, knew he wouldn't have a problem with it. He was mostly right. The ship sliced through the first series of twists with ease. Luke's piloting skill and prescience in the Force combining with the X-Wing's innate maneuverability to leave the alien ships far behind. He shot through an open valley, changed direction toward a new canyon, and nearly lost control as a burst of blue fire raked across the port side fuselage. "It's all right," he called back to R2, feeling a flash of annoyance with himself as the X-Wing plunged again into the relative safety of his chosen ravine. This had happened before. Focusing his attention and the Force too narrowly in one direction had a tendency to blind him to anything happening outside that cone. Clearly, at least one of the alien pilots had been smart enough to abandon the chase and fly up over the maze to wait for the target to show himself. But the gambit had failed, and if the terrain cooperated, he wouldn't get another chance at it. The X-Wing emerged into a second valley, this one smaller than the first, and veered off into another ravine. Letting the Force guide his hands, Luke watched the cliffs around him, looking for just the right place. And then, suddenly, there it was. On both sides of the X-Wing, steep cliffs rose upward, one of them angling sharply toward the other until only a tiny ribbon of daylight showed at the top between them. Lines and clusters of drab and scraggly bushes clung to various parts of the craggy rock, with a thick matting of brown bushes and squat trees covering the canyon floor below. Ahead and behind, the canyon curved sharply to either side, leaving this center part as an isolated bubble surrounded by rock. It was the perfect place to go to ground. R2 didn't squeal or screech as Luke swung the starfighter around in a 180-degree skid in a classic smuggler's reverse. Probably, Luke decided, as he fed power to the thrusters, because the little droid was too busy holding on for dear life. For a handful of seconds, the X-Wing bucked beneath him, and he fought hard for stability as it tried to flip out of control. Outside, the canyon walls shooting past began to slow, and as they did so, he eased off on the drive and keyed in the repulsor lifts. The deceleration pressure crushing him against the seat cushions faded. Spinning the X-Wing around to face forward again, he threw a quick look around. Directly ahead, a pair of squat but bushy trees rose up from the canyon floor, straddling what appeared to be a dry creek bed, their trunks just the right distance apart. Killing the last of the X-Wing's forward velocity, he dropped its nose down to slide neatly between the tree trunks. "There," he said, running the last steps of the landing cycle and shutting down the repulsor lifts. "That wasn't so hard now, was it?" There was a weak and slightly shaky whistle from behind him. Apparently, R2 hadn't found his voice yet. Smiling tightly, Luke popped the canopy, wincing at the high-pitched scratching sounds as dozens of thorn-edged leaves scraped across the transparasteel and slid off his helmet and gloves. The air flooding in from outside was cool and smelled vaguely mossy. For a long minute, he listened, stretching out with force-enhanced senses for sounds of pursuit. But there was nothing except the normal sounds of wind rustling through the leaves and the distant chirps of avians or insects. "I think we've lost them," he told R2. "At least for now. You figured out where we are?" R2 beeped, still sounding a little dazed, and a map appeared on the computer display. Luke studied it. Not too bad, not too good either. They were no more than 10 kilometers from Mara's cave, but most of the territory between here and there consisted of the same kind of narrow gorges and rocky cliffs they'd just been flying through. At least a full day's travel. Probably 2, possibly 3. On the other hand, the very roughness of the ground would give them better cover than they could reasonably have asked for. All in all, a pretty fair trade. But it wouldn't be much of a trade if the aliens found them before they even got started. "Come on," he said, easing out of the cockpit and rolling out to the ground. The attempt to avoid the leaf thorns was only partially successful, but only a couple of them actually drew blood. "Let's get the pack sorted out and get out of here." It was the work of a few minutes to break out the camo neck Card had sent along and to pull it snugly over the X-Wing. Then, as an extra precaution, he cut up some of the smaller bushes and tree limbs with his lightsaber and scattered them on top of the net. It wasn't perfect, especially at close range, but it was the best he could do in the available time. Karn's people had also put his survival pack together, assembling the supplies and loading them aboard the X-Wing, while Luke hurried through the data work necessary for getting off Sejancich. And as Luke had come to expect from the smugglers' organization over the years, they'd done a first-rate job of it. Split into two separate carry packs, the supplies included ration bars, water filter bottles, med packs, glow rods, a good supply of synth rope, a spare blaster, a survival tent with bedroll, and even a small selection of low-yield grenades.
"I'm surprised they didn't try to cram a land speeder in," Luke grunted, as he hoisted one of the packs experimentally onto his shoulders.
It was heavy enough, but the weight had been well distributed and would be reasonably easy to carry.
"I guess we'll have to leave the other pack here. You ready to do a little climbing?"
R2 warbled questioningly, his dome swiveling to peer first one direction down the canyon and then the other.
"No, that's where they'll expect us to come out," Luke told him.
He pointed upward, toward one of the cliffs towering over them.
"That's our route, up there."
The droid swiveled his dome again, whistling skittishly as he leaned way back to look up.
"Relax. We won't have to go all the way to the top," Luke calmed him. "See that gap about two-thirds of the way up? If I read the aerial pictures right, that should lead into a cut that'll take us the rest of the way to the top."
R2 warbled forlornly, looking back and forth along the canyon again.
"No, R2, we can't go that way," Luke told him firmly. "And we don't have time to argue the point. Even if those ships can't get in there, they may have smaller ones back at the fortress. And they can always come in on foot, too. You want to be sitting around when they get here?"
The droid beeped emphatically, swiveling himself around. He started bumping determinedly along the dry creek bed toward the base of the cliff below the gap Luke had pointed out. Smiling, Luke gave his pack one final settling shrug, and stretching out with the force, he lifted R2 high enough off the ground to clear the undergrowth and headed toward the cliff. As it turned out, the climb had looked more daunting than it really was. Though certainly steep enough, the wall wasn't nearly the impossibly vertical slope that it had seemed from the canyon floor. Hand and footholds were plentiful. The whole cliff face seemed to be dotted with narrow ledges and small caves, and the bushes and vines provided sturdy handholds as well. The only problematic part was R2, but even that quickly settled into a more or less comfortable routine. Finding a secure place to stand, Luke would use the force to lift the droid up past him to a narrow ledge or conveniently spaced pair of caves, hold him in place while using the synth rope to lash him to the nearest bushes, then climb past him to the next convenient resting point, and repeat. R2 didn't care for any part of the procedure, of course. Midway up the cliff, though, he at least stopped complaining about it. They were almost to the gap, and Luke was once again catching up to the point where he'd anchored R2 when he heard the faint voice. He stopped, one hand gripping a lumpy vine, and listened. But there was nothing but the distant insect chirping he'd been hearing since they landed. Running through his Jedi sensory enhancement techniques, he stretched out his hearing. But though the chirps became louder and more varied, the voice he thought he'd heard wasn't there. There was a loud squeal from above him, R2 whistling softly in his enhanced hearing.
"I thought I heard something,"
he murmured back, the words booming in his head. Hastily, he eased his hearing back to normal.
"It was like a voice."
He broke off at R2's startled twitter.
"What is it?"
he asked, looking up. The droid was facing down and along the cliff, turning his head. Luke tracked along his gaze and froze. Perched on a thorn-leafed bush, not 3 meters away, was a small, slack-winged, brown-gray creature. Watching him.
Take it easy.
Luke soothed R2, taking a moment to study the creature. About 30 centimeters long from head to talons, it was covered with smooth-looking skin. Its folded wings were more of the same, though it was hard to guess their size, and arched slightly over in a way that reminded Luke of hunched shoulders. The head was proportionally small and streamlined, with a pair of dark eyes nestled beneath fleshy folds and two horizontal slashes beneath them. The upper slash was undulating with the steady rhythm of respiration, while the lower was pressed into a tight slit. A pair of segmented, wide-taloned feet gripped the bush it was perched on, apparently not bothered in the least by the sharp thorns. The overall effect was like something halfway between a Minock and a praying Macthyr, and he wondered if it was related to either of those species. R2 gave another warble, this one wary.
"I don't think it means us any harm,"
Luke assured him, still watching the creature.
"I don't sense any danger from it. And we're a little big for a snack for something that size."
Unless, of course, they hunted in packs. Still watching the creature, he stretched out with the force, searching for others of the species. There were definitely more of them in the canyon, but most seemed to be fairly distant. The lower slit on the creature's face opened, revealing twin rows of tiny, sharp teeth, and emitted a loud chirp.
"Who are you?"
Luke blinked in surprise. There was the voice he thought he'd heard, except that this time it was clear enough to understand. But had it come from...
"What?"
he asked. The creature chirped again.
"Who are you?"
He was right. It was the creature who'd spoken. Only it hadn't spoken. Not really. But then... how had Luke understood? And then, abruptly, he understood.
"I'm Luke Skywalker," he said, stretching toward the creature with the force. "Jedi Knight of the New Republic. Who are you?"
The creature emitted a short series of chirps.
"What do you do here, Jedi Knight Skywalker?"
"I'm looking for a friend," Luke said.
His guess had been right. While he couldn't understand the creature's actual chirping language, he was pulling the essence of the communication from its mind via the Force. An extremely rare event in his experience, and it probably implied the creatures were at least marginally Force-sensitive.
"She landed near here nearly 2 weeks ago, and then disappeared. Do you know where she is?"
The creature seemed to shy back a bit. It fluffed its wings, partially open, resettled them across its back. It chirped again.
"Who is this friend?"
"Her name is Mara Jade," Luke said.
"Is she another Jedi Knight?"
"Sort of," Luke hedged. Mara had dropped by his Jedi Academy occasionally over the past 8 years, but she'd never stayed long enough to complete her training. Actually, there were times Luke wondered if she'd ever truly begun it.
"Do you know where she is?"
The wings fluffed again as the creature chirped.
"I know nothing."
"Really?"
Luke said, letting his tone cool just a bit. He didn't even need the Force for this one. He'd watched Jason, Jaina, and Anakin pull this trick enough times to recognize guilty knowledge when he saw it.
"What if I told you a Jedi can always tell when someone's lying?"
From behind him came a loud and authoritative chirp.
"Leave the young one alone!"
Luke turned his head. Perched on the bushes and craggy rocks on the other side of the cliff face were three more of the creatures. They were each twice as big as the first one, but even without the size differential, the subtle differences between adult and young were instantly apparent.
"Your pardon," he said to them. I wasn't trying to intimidate him. Perhaps you can help me in my search for my friend.
One of the creatures spread his wings and gave a short hop to a bush closer to Luke, twisting his head one way and then the other, as if studying the intruder out of each eye individually.
You are not one of the others. Who are you?
I think you know, Luke said, a quiet sense prompting him to play a hunch. Why don't you tell me instead who you are?
The creature seemed to consider.
I'm Hunter of Winds. I bargain for this nesting of the Quamquay.
In the name of the New Republic, I greet you, Hunter of Winds, Luke said gravely. I presume you know of the New Republic?
The elder Quamquay fluffed his wings exactly the same way the young one had.
I have heard. What is the New Republic to us?
I suppose that depends on what you want it to be, Luke said. But that's a matter for diplomats and bargainers to discuss. I'm here to help a friend.
Hunter of Winds chirped decisively.
We have no knowledge of any strangers.
But we do,
the younger Quamquay chirped from behind Luke.
The Quamja spoke of
Hunter of Winds cut him off with a squawk.
Is your name Seeker After Stupidity?
He demanded pointedly.
Be silent!
Perhaps you have merely forgotten, Luke suggested diplomatically. A nesting bargainer must have many other matters to think about, after all.
Hunter of Winds fluffed his wings.
What happens outside this nesting does not properly concern us. Go to another nesting of the Quamquay, or to the Quamja, if you dare. Perhaps they will help you.
All right, Luke said. Will you guide me to them?
They are outside this nesting,
Hunter of Winds chirped.
They are not our concern.
I see, Luke said. Tell me, Hunter of Winds, have you ever had a friend in danger?
The Quamquay spread his wings, his two companions following suit.
This conversation is ended. Young one, come!
He leaped out from his bush, gliding away toward the canyon floor below on outstretched wings, his two companions following. Turning back, Luke saw the young Quamquay follow them. R2 grunted contemptuously.
Don't blame them too much, Luke told him with a sigh. There may be cultural or political entanglements here we don't know about.
He resumed his climb.
Or they may just be wary of getting involved in someone else's fight, he added. We've certainly seen enough of that over the years.
5 minutes later, they'd reached the gap. Luke had been right. The cut continued upward toward the top of the cliff at a much more leisurely angle, while still keeping them under tree cover the whole way.
Perfect,
Luke said, peering up along it.
Let's get up to the top and see where we can go from here.
Collecting the synth rope, he started to coil it, and suddenly R2 emitted a startled squawk.
What is it?
Luke demanded, grabbing reflexively for his lightsaber as he spun around. There was no danger around them that he could see or sense.
R2, what is it?
He asked again, turning his attention to the droid. R2 was gazing back down into the valley along the way they'd come, moaning mournfully. Frowning, Luke followed along the droid's line of sight and felt his breath catch in his throat. Down on the valley floor, their X-wing had vanished.
No,
Luke breathed, gazing hard at the browns and grays down there. His first hopeful thought was that his camouflage job had simply been better than he realized, and that the starfighter was still right where they'd left it. but a moment of careful searching with Jedi-enhanced senses put that hope quietly to rest. The X-Wing was indeed gone. R2 warbled anxiously.
It's all right, Luke soothed.
It's all right. And to his own mild surprise, he found he actually meant it. The X-Wing's disappearing act was frustrating and annoying, but oddly enough, there was no sense of danger or fear accompanying it. Not even any serious concern, despite the fact that the loss of their ship meant no chance for a quick escape should the situation warrant it. A prodding from the Force? A sense, perhaps, that the X-Wing was merely misplaced and not actually lost? Unfortunately, he realized soberly, it could just as easily be a prodding in the opposite direction. That the loss of the ship didn't matter, because he would not be leaving this world alive anyway. Unbidden, as an image of Yoda rose from his memory, the old Jedi Master sighing with weariness as he settled onto his bed for the last time. Luke could remember his gut-churning fear at Yoda's frailness, could recall the exact tone of his voice as he protested to Yoda that he must not die.
Strong am I with the Force,
Yoda had gently reproved his student.
But not that strong. Twilight is upon me, and soon night will fall. That is the way of things, the way of the Force.
Luke took a deep breath. Obi-Wan had died. Yoda had died. And someday, it would be his turn to face that same journey. And if this was the place where that journey would begin, so be it. He was a Jedi, and would face it as one. In the meantime, the reason he had come here had not changed. Nothing we can do about it now, he told R2, turning away from the valley and returning to the task of coiling the synth rope. Let's get to the top and see where we go from there. From directly above came a soft chirp.
There are better ways to pass.
Luke looked up. The young Quam Kwe was back, hovering on some updraft he'd found and gazing down at them.
Are you offering to help us? He asked.
The Quam Kwe bent one of his wings slightly, the change in air pressure sending him sidling over to the cliff face beside Luke.
He caught one of the bushes in his talons as he reached it, folding his wings behind him.
I will help you. The Quamja have said another has arrived and is with them. I will take you there.
Thank you, Luke said, wondering if he should ask about his missing X-Wing. But after the young Quam Kwe's skittishness earlier, it probably would be better to leave any interrogations for later. May I ask why you're willing to take the risk?
I am known to some of the younger Quam Ja. I do not fear them.
I'm not necessarily talking about the Quam Ja, Luke said, wanting to make sure the young alien genuinely understood the risks. The others Hunter of Wind spoke of may also try to stop us.
I understand that.
The alien fluffed his wings.
But you asked Hunter of Winds if he had ever had a friend in danger. I have.
Luke smiled. I understand, he said. And I'm honored to have your assistance. I'm Luke Skywalker, as I said, and this is my droid, R2. What's your name? The Quam Kwe spread his wings and made a short hop to a bush in front of them.
I am too young yet to have a name. I am called merely Child of Winds.
Child of Winds, Luke repeated, eyeing him thoughtfully. You wouldn't by any chance be related to Hunter of Winds, would you?
He is my sire.
Child of Winds chirped.
It is indeed true about the wisdom of the Jedi Knights.
Luke suppressed a smile. Sometimes, he said. But we should get moving now. Along the way, perhaps you can tell me more about your people.
I would be honored,
Child of Wind said, spreading his wings eagerly.
Come, I will show you the path.
Chapter 3 The communications blister on the New Republic dreadnought Peregrine was something of an anachronism among modern warships, a throwback to the pre-Clone Wars design philosophy that had prevailed at the time the Peregrine and its Katana fleet sister ships had been built. Not only was the ship's entire primary antenna array located in the blister, but so were the complex and delicate encryption-decryption computers. The handful of other Katana fleet dreadnoughts still in New Republic service had had their comm blisters extensively renovated, with the encrypt-decrypt equipment moved inside into a more sheltered area between the bridge and intelligence ops. But somehow, no matter how often the renovation procedure was talked about, the Peregrine always seemed to slip through the cracks in the work schedule. Wedge Antilles had wondered about that on occasion. There was, he knew, still some bad blood between General Garm Bel Iblis and a few of the New Republic's upper echelon, dating back to Bel Iblis's years of running his own private war against the Empire after his falling out with Mon Mothma. Wedge had always suspected the lack of renovation on this. The General's flagship was tied to that animosity. It wasn't until Wedge and Rogue Squadron had been permanently assigned to Bel Iblis that he'd learned the truth. Intelligence sections, Bel Iblis had explained to him, were crowded in public places, and having a decrypted signal piped to bridge or command room gave abundant opportunity for anyone with a modicum of skill and a surplus of curiosity to tap into the conversation. A comm blister, in contrast, was about as isolated a place as one could find aboard a warship. And having the encrypt-decrypt computer close at hand meant that the message began and ended right there. Whenever any really private transmissions were due, that was where Bel Iblis was to be found. He and Wedge were there now, at Admiral Akbar's personal request.
I understand your concerns, General Bel Iblis,
Akbar said, his face filling the comm display, his huge eyes swiveling around to take in Wedge as well.
And I do not disagree with your assessment, but I must nevertheless turn down your request.
I strongly urge you to reconsider, Admiral,
Bel Iblis said stiffly.
I appreciate the political situation on Coruscant, but that can't be allowed to blind us to the purely military considerations here.
The Mon Cal's lip tendrils seemed to stiffen.
Unfortunately, there are no longer any pure military considerations involving the Kar-Mas issue. Political and ethical questions have pervaded everything.
Unusual combination,
Wedge murmured under his breath. One of Akbar's eyes swiveled briefly toward him, before turning back to Bel Iblis.
The final line of the situation is that any serious New Republic presence over Bothawi at this point would be construed as support of the Bothans against their critics.
It would be nothing of the sort,
Bel Iblis objected.
It would be a voice of calm and reason in the middle of a very dangerous flashpoint. There are 68 warships here already, all of them engaged in a 12-way glaring contest with each other. All of them ready to jump if any of the others so much as sneeze. There has got to be someone here who can mediate any problems before they collapse into an all-out war.
Akbar sighed, a darkly rasping sound.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, General. But the High Council and Senate are an ultimate authority here, and they have come to a different conclusion.
Bel Iblis threw a baleful glance at Wedge.
I trust you'll continue trying to change their minds.
Yes, indeed. But whether I am successful or not,
You will not be the one chosen for the dubious honor of mediator. President Gavrisim has already selected another task for you.
More important than keeping the peace over Bothawi?
Far more important. If Bothawi is the flashpoint, then it is the Kaamas document which is the spark.
Wedge felt a sudden premonition hit him. Could Gavrisim actually be considering? He was.
President Gavrisim has therefore concluded that the New Republic's best chance of defusing the controversy is to obtain an intact copy of the document. To that end, you are to proceed immediately to Ord Trassi, where you will begin assembling a force for an information raid on the Imperial Ubiquity Base at Yaga Minor.
Wedge stole a furtive glance at Bel Iblis. The general's expression hadn't changed, but there was just enough of a tightness in his jaw to show he was thinking along the same lines Wedge was.
With all due respect, Admiral, Bel Iblis said, President Gavrisim must be joking. Yaga Minor is possibly the most heavily defended system in Imperial or New Republic space, and that's just considering a straight-line attack, where it doesn't matter which enemy positions come under fire. Having to keep the enemy data system intact adds 5 extra layers of difficulty to the whole operation.
The President is well aware of the challenges involved,
Akbar said, his voice even more gravelly than usual.
I'll be honest. I don't like this any more than you do. But it has to be tried. If war breaks out over this issue, we don't have enough ships or troops to either force or maintain the peace. The entire New Republic could conceivably collapse into total civil war.
Bel Iblis looked at Wedge again, turned back to the display.
Yes, sir,
he said.
Unfortunately, I'm forced to agree with your assessment.
I may also say that if there's any way this can be done, you are the one who can do it.
Bel Iblis smiled wryly.
Thank you for your confidence, Admiral. I'll do my best.
Good. You and your task force are to leave Bothawi immediately for Ord Trassi. I'll be quietly sending you the rest of your ships over the next 2 weeks, at which time I expect you to have a battle plan formulated and ready to go.
Understood,
Bel Iblis said.
What about special equipment or units?
Anything the New Republic can supply is yours. Tell me what you need, and I'll have it sent to you.
Bel Iblis nodded.
We will, of course, need total secrecy on this,
he warned.
If even a hint leaks to the Empire, what little chance we have will be gone.
The secrecy will be complete,
Akbar promised.
I've already set a cover story in motion which should convince any Imperial spies that the ships are secretly being assembled in the outer regions of the Kothlis system for the defense of Bothawi, should that become necessary.
That should work,
Bel Iblis said.
Provided they don't head to Kothlis and take a look for themselves.
2 Rendili space docks have already been moved to the Kothlis system. They'll be equipped with dummy ships carrying the proper IDs and markings for the benefit of any Imperials who happen by.
Interesting.
Bel Iblis cocked an eyebrow.
So this isn't just some slice-of-the-moment idea Gavrisim came up with last night. This has been in the works for some time now.
The Mon Cal nodded his massive head.
The preparations were begun the day after the riot at the Combined Clans building on Bothawi. With General Solo's implication in that incident, the President knew it would no longer be possible for the New Republic government to make any overt political moves without our motives coming under fire.
I understand the reasoning involved,
Bel Iblis said heavily.
Ord Trassi it is, then.
A liaison team from my office will be waiting there when you arrive. Good luck, General.
Thank you, Admiral. Bel Iblis out.
The general touched a key, and the transmission ended.
Which doesn't mean I entirely agree with it,
he commented under his breath to the blank display as he turned to Wedge.
Well, General, comments?
Wedge shook his head.
I was on an information raid once, back when we were trying to get data on Grand Admiral Makati out at the Boudelais Library,
he said.
I think the bit pushers estimated afterward that we were about 80% successful. And that was Boudelais, not Yaga Minor.
Yes, I've read the reports on that raid,
Belleblis said, stroking his mustache thoughtfully.
This is definitely not gonna be easy.
Wedge grimaced.
Meanwhile, Bothawe keeps collecting warships like a floodlight collects night insects. Eventually, sir, someone's going to try to take advantage of that.
I agree,
Belleblis said.
Which is why I asked you to come up here with me this afternoon.
Oh?
Wedge said, regarding him closely.
Then you knew this was coming?
Not the Yaga Minor raid specifically, Belleblis said. But I had a feeling Coruscant would turn down my request to stay here and keep order. It also occurred to me that if my task force was ordered away, as we now indeed have been, the Rogue Squadron isn't technically part of that task force.
Wedge frowned.
You've lost me, General. I thought we'd been permanently attached to you.
To me, yes,
Belleblis agreed.
But not to my task force. It's a fine but very important technical distinction.
I'll take your word for it,
Wedge said, trying without success to sift confirmation of that point from his own memory of the New Republic military regs.
So, what does that mean?
Belleblis swiveled the encrypt station chair around and sat down.
It means I agree with you that someone is likely to take advantage of this mess,
he said, folding his hands in his lap.
Possibly the shadowy vengeance organization that keeps throwing riots and demanding the Bothans pay through the snout for their part in the destruction of Ka'amas.
Yes,
Wedge said slowly, as a sudden thought hit him.
And since the Bothan contribution to that attack was to sabotage the Ka'amas planetary shields...
Belleblis nodded.
Very good. Yes. My guess is someone's going to try to take out Bothawe's shields.
Wedge whistled softly.
Do you think that's even possible? The Bothans are supposed to have one of the best shield systems in the galaxy.
They did once, back at the height of the Empire,
Belleblis said.
Whether they've kept it up, I don't know. But of course an enemy wouldn't have to take down the entire grid to do serious damage. Dropping the shield just over Drev's Tarn would open up a hole you could pour a lot of turbo laser damage through.
Yes, Wedge murmured. Trouble is, it wouldn't be just the Bothans who'd get hammered.
That is indeed the problem,
Belleblis agreed soberly.
At last count, there were over 300 megacorporations with their headquarters on Bothawe. Plus thousands of smaller companies, and at least 50 pledge and commodity exchanges.
Wedge nodded. It wouldn't exactly mean universal economic chaos if they were hit, but it would add a considerable degree of extra anger and resentment to the stew already heating up out there. And with all those warships trying to stare each other down overhead, it might do considerably more than just heat the stew.
What do you want me to do?
Belleblis seemed to be studying his face.
I want you to go down to the surface and make sure that doesn't happen.
Wedge had had a sneaking suspicion that was the direction this conversation was going. It came as something of a shock just the same.
All by myself?
He asked.
Or do you think I might need the rest of Rogue Squadron too?
Belleblis smiled.
Relax, Wedge. It's not as bad as it sounds,
he said.
I'm not expecting you to stand in front of the Drev Star and Generator Dome, a blaster in each hand, and hold off the third Imperial heavy armor.
So far, vengeance has shown more trickery and subterfuge than brute force. And trickery and subterfuge are things a couple of clever X-Wing pilots ought to have a good chance of spotting.
So the proposed scout party was up to two now, Wedge noted, thereby doubling their chances of rooting out this theoretical splinter in a sandhill.
Did you have anyone in particular in mind as the second clever X-Wing pilot?
Of course, Bell Iblis said. Commander Horn.
I see,
Wedge said between suddenly stiff lips. A search for a hidden saboteur, and Bell Iblis had immediately come up with Corran Horn. Could he somehow have deduced Corran's carefully hidden Jedi skills?
Why him?
Bell Iblis' eyebrows lifted slightly.
Because his father-in-law is a smuggler, he said. He's bound to have a network of contacts Horn will be able to access.
Ah, Wedge said, relaxing a bit. I hadn't thought about that.
That's why I'm a senior general, Bell Iblis said dryly. You better get below and give Horn the good news. You heard Akbar. I only have a couple of weeks to pull all this together, and I want you back with the squadron when we hit Yagga Minor.
We'll do what we can, Wedge promised. You want us to take one of the Peregrine's unmarked shuttles?
Bell Iblis nodded.
X-Wings would be a little conspicuous. Leave your uniforms, too. But take your military IDs in case you have to pull rank on some bureaucrat. I'll let you know when I want you at Ord Trassi.
Understood, Wedge said.
Good,
Bell Iblis said.
I'm gonna stay up here for a few minutes. I can transmit to the other commanders from here as well as I can from the bridge or my office. Akbar said immediately, though. So as soon as the other ships are ready to go, you'll need to be off the Peregrine before that.
We will, sir,
Wedge said, moving toward the door.
Good luck with your battle plan, General.
Bell Iblis smiled faintly.
Good luck with yours.
They were just hitting Bothawi's atmosphere when Corran, who'd been leaning against the side viewport looking back toward the shuttle's stern, turned around and settled himself back into his seat.
They're gone, he announced.
Wedge glanced at his displays. The ships of the Peregrine Task Force were indeed no longer registering.
That they are, he agreed. We're on our own now.
Corran shook his head.
This is crazy, Wedge. And you say he specifically told you to take me? Yes, but it didn't have anything to do with your hidden talents, Wedge assured him. He thinks you'll be able to access Booster's smuggling network.
Corran snorted.
That might work, if Booster was speaking to me these days.
Wedge glanced sideways at him.
What? He's not still mad about that trick we pulled with the Hoopster's prank off Sifkrik, is he? I thought we decided they weren't carrying any contraband and let them go.
No, they weren't. And yes, he is,
Corran said.
Clean or not, the Sifkris decided they didn't want smugglers carrying cargoes for them, and banned the Hoopster's prank forthwith from future Palmworm shipments.
Wedge winced. Ouch.
Doesn't mean they won't get in anyway, Corran continued with a shrug. It just means they'll have to come up with different ships or new ID camouflage or something. But it's a nuisance, and Booster hates nuisances. Especially official nuisances.
Wedge said.
Sorry about that. Maybe Mirax will be able to calm him down.
Oh, I'm sure she will,
Corran said.
Come to think of it, though, I'm not sure Booster even has any interests on Bothawi. The planet's got so many other smuggling groups crawling all over it, he may have decided to leave it alone.
Oh, that's handy, Wedge grumbled.
Hey, you're the one who wanted to get back to the exciting life of an X-Wing pilot, remember?
Corran reminded him.
You could have been safely flying a computer somewhere on Coruscant if you wanted.
Wedge made a face.
No thanks. Tried it, didn't like it. So you're not expecting us to find any help down there at all?
There was a brief silence.
"That's an interesting question," Corrin murmured at last, his voice sounding odd. "Actually, I think I am."
Wedge threw him a frown.
"You are what? Expecting to find help?"
"I think so. Yes,"
Corrin said, that same strange tone in his voice.
"Don't ask how or where. I think so."
"Let me guess," Wedge said. "Jedi hunch?"
Corrin nodded.
"Jedi hunch."
Wedge smiled.
"Good,"
he said, already feeling better about this whole mission.
"In that case, we don't have anything to worry about."
"Well, no," Corrin said slowly. "I don't think I'd go so far as to say that."
Chapter 4
Ta-Sparta! Beware! To the starboard!
The Tagorian female at the wild card sensor station called, her normally fluid, mewling speech now clipped and harsh.
"At the 255-14 angle!"
"I'm on it!"
Another tight voice came over the bridge comm unit. The edges of 100 asteroids rolling sedately past the viewport flickered with reflected light as one of the wild card's turbolasers flashed, then blazed even more brightly as the target asteroid shattered into dust and fire. Seated in the back of the bridge, out of the way, Shada Ducal mentally shook her head. Negotiating an asteroid field was never an easy task, but it seemed to her that Tagorian and at least one of the turbolaser gunners were getting themselves far too worked up over the whole operation. Either they were naturally excitable, or else young and inexperienced. Neither possibility exactly filled her with confidence. Both made her wonder about their captain's wisdom in bringing the two of them along in the first place. Perhaps the captain was feeling the same way.
"Calm down, Hasishi,"
Talencard cautioned the Tagorian from his seat behind the helm and co-pilot stations.
"You too, Charl. Just because this asteroid field is larger than others you've encountered, doesn't mean it has to be treated any differently. A light touch, blast only the rocks that are in immediate danger to us, and let Dankin maneuver the ship around the others."
The Tagorian's ears twitched.
"I obey, chieftain,"
she said.
"Yes, sir,"
the gunner's voice added. Not that the admonition made any appreciable difference, at least not that Shada could see. Hasishi still continued to snap out her targeting locks, and Chal still fired full-power turbolaser blasts, whether the target warranted that much of a kick or not. But then, maybe it wasn't just them. Maybe they were merely sensing and reacting to the nervousness Card himself was feeling. Shada shifted her gaze to focus on his profile. He was hiding it well, actually, with only cheek and jaw muscles betraying the tension there. But Mistral training included the reading of faces and body language, and to her eyes, Card's steadily growing apprehension was as obvious as a navigational beacon. And the upcoming stopover at Pembroke 2 was only the first leg of their trip. What would he be like, she wondered uneasily, by the time they actually reached Exocron? There was a particularly bright flash outside, as a particularly large asteroid was blown to dust.
"Oh my!"
a gloomy metallic voice murmured from Shada's right. She turned to look at the C-3PO protocol droid strapped into the seat next to her. He was staring at the viewport, wincing with every turbolaser blast.
"Trouble?"
she asked.
"I'm sorry, Mistress Shada,"
he said, managing to sound prim and miserable at the same time.
"I've never entirely enjoyed space travel, and this in particular reminds me of a rather unpleasant incident in the past."
"It should be over soon,"
she soothed him.
"Just try to relax."
The Mistral Shadow Guard had never used droids all that much, but one of Shada's uncles had had one when she was growing up, and she'd always had something of a soft spot for them. And in 3PO's case, she felt a particularly personal sympathy for his position.
Leia Organa Solo's personal translator droid. He had been suddenly and summarily offered to Card for this voyage. No notice, no questions, no apologies. In many ways, it echoed Shada's own long and unquestioning service to the Mistral. A service that had come to a sudden and permanent end a month ago on the windswept roof of the Resonim Entertainment Complex, where Shada had dared to put her personal honor above direct orders from the Eleven, the rulers of her shattered world of Emberline. Would the rest of the Mistral be hunting her now? Her old friend Karoli Dulin had hinted that would be the case. But with the New Republic simmering towards self-destruction in a flurry of petty wars and revived grudges, surely the Mistral had more important things to do than hunt down even a perceived traitor. On the other hand, if Karoli had reported Shada's reasons for her defiance, had repeated the words of scorn for leaders who had now forgotten the proud and honorable tradition the Mistral had once held to, then the Eleven might indeed consider her worth the effort to track down. Of all motivations to action, she had long since learned that injured pride was one of the most powerful, and one of the most destructive as well, to both the victim and the hunter. Emotion caught her eye, Card half turning in his seat to look at her.
"Enjoying the ride?"
he asked.
"Oh, it's great fun,"
she told him.
"Nothing I like better than doing tight maneuvers with a cold crew."
The Tagorian's fur expanded just a little, but she didn't comment, and she kept her eyes on her displays.
"New experiences are what give zest to life," Card said mildly.
"In my line of work, new experiences usually mean trouble,"
Shada countered.
"I hope you weren't planning on sneaking in, by the way. The way your people are lighting up the field, all of Pembroke 2 knows we're coming by now."
As if to underline her words, the asteroids outside flickered with a multiple sputter of turbo laser fire.
"Actually, according to Mara, most ships have to do some blasting on the way in,"
Card said. His fingers, Shada noted, were tapping gently but restlessly on his armrest.
"Even the locals, who supposedly know the routes in and out..."
"We have cleared the asteroid field, Chieftain Card,"
the Tagorian mewled. Shada looked back at the viewport. There were still some asteroids floating past, but for the most part, the sky was indeed clear.
"The planetary landing beacons are in sight,"
Asishi added, turning her head and fixing her yellow eyes on Shada.
"Your junior crew drone may now cease her nervousness."
Shada held that gaze for another two heartbeats. Then, deliberately, she turned away. Most of the Wild Card's crew had been verbally poking at her in one way or another ever since their departure from Coruscant. Mazik's people had done the same back when she first joined his smuggling group. The usual reaction, she had long ago realized, of a tight-knit crew who have just had a stranger thrust into their midst. One of Mazik's techs had unwisely crossed the line from verbal to physical jabs, and as a result had spent a month in a neural reconstruction facility. Out here, at the edge of civilization, she hoped the Wild Card's crew wouldn't have to learn the lesson the same way. The pilot half turned around.
"What now, Chief?"
"Take us into orbit," Card told him. "There's only one place on the planet that can handle a ship this size. The air with that spaceport. They should be calling with landing instructions any time now."
Right on cue, the comm crackled.
"Pristam Shun,"
a sharp voice snapped.
"Sikoha! Her earthwat, Rosput Dunsunk, Rosput Hok Dunshokswofwofur."
Shada frowned.
"I thought you said they spoke basic here,"
she said.
"They do," Card said. "They must be trying to throw us."
He cocked an eyebrow at the droid beside Shada.
"3PO, do you recognize it?"
"Oh, yes, Captain Card,"
the droid said, with the first sign of enthusiasm Shada had seen in him since the trip started.
I am fluent in over 6 million forms of communication. This is the dominant Jarellian dialect, a language whose antecedents date back to...
What did he say?
Shada interrupted gently. Protocol droids, in her limited experience,